Welcome to the podcast of All Means All. In this episode, Hannah Solly, Ayana Patak, Janet Engin, and Sam Blankensee will talk about gender and school policy.
So the title of our chapter is Gender and School Policy. And I think we felt that in order to answer this question, we first needed to define, well, what does gender mean? And the use, the nuances around the use of the word gender. And also we need to consider, well, what school policies are affected by gender. So Sam, can you talk about how we define gender or different definitions of gender?
Yeah, so there's lots of definitions of gender. And I guess as we were looking through it, we were going, okay, is this mainly about women and girls? Is this women, girls, trans and non-binary people? Is this only trans and non-binary people? So we looked, and I think the World Health Organization has a good definition, which looks at the characteristics of women and men, girls and boys that are socially constructed. It talks about gender being the norms, behaviors and roles of women, men, girls and boys, and masculine and femininity, but that it differs from society to society and it changes over time. Something that's really important is that gender is hierarchical, and it produces inequalities, and it also intersects with all of the other characteristics that you can talk about, so race and ethnicity, sexual orientation, and so many others. And that it's different but connected to sex, so how you are assigned at birth, your biological organs, hormones, as well as slightly separate but connected to your gender identity, so your innate sense of gender, your inner gender. And your inner gender may or may not correspond with your sex assigned at birth.
And also gender roles that can be constructed by individual cultures or societies as well.
Absolutely.
So then, and Janet, what does school policy encompass? And how does gender affect school policies?
Okay, you know, schools have policies in for many procedures and everything that goes in the school. And also educational policies, policymakers set the policies to make the school and learning environment, safe learning environment, that students can grow and learn. So when we look at the policies, we can talk about macro level policies in education, and macro level policies are like international policies and national policies in general. International policies is like policies set by the international organizations like UNESCO and EU. For example, UNESCO has education for all, and then to make sure that all boys and girls are in school and take education. And EU set some strategy, for example, gender equality strategy, so that all EU countries try to set their policies, comply with these policies. And among the macro level policies, we have national policies, and those policies are set by the national governments. And then they are generally related to the admission requirements, for example, or providing different schooling type, girls and boys schooling in terms of gender policy, and some other training of teachers, admissions of teachers, the other policies related to, for example, the facilities of the schools, providing facilities of the schools in most of the centralized countries. In some countries, this can be at the local level policies. And also we have intermediary level policies. I think we see this in some countries, and maybe Sam can give us an example. Yeah. About that.
So I guess in Ireland, the way it works is we have our government sets certain policies and tells what we call management bodies, mm-hmm. how they would like some of those policies to be put in place. So those management bodies may be religious, they may be non-religious, they may be like semi-government. Most of them are away from the government, and they get asked to then run a school. And depending on the ethos and the values of that organization, the schools can look quite different. And often the government will set guidelines, and these bodies then decide what parts of the guidelines are going to be implemented in what school. So government sets curriculum, but those bodies decide on kind of what the tone of each school will be and how those policies are implemented.
For example, in Turkish context, we have centralized education system, and then almost all the policies are set by the Ministry of Education in a national level. So this is different from other countries, maybe. And that's why I wanted to ask Sam to give example about that, because we don't see this in Turkey.
And Ayana, in India, any differences?
So, yeah, in the Indian context, all of these major subjects fall under three particular lists. There is the union list, the state list, and the concurrent list. So education as a subject falls in the concurrent list, which means both the nation, the central level as well as the state levels have some say on the way in which education will go on. For example, the policy is set at the national level, but then, like you said, in Ireland, the regional bodies also have some kind of control in the manner in which curriculum is set. For example, there are different state boards across all the different states. So there is some kind of flexibility in those areas, but the larger framework is set by the central government.
So the ultimate purpose of the educational policies and school policies are to create gender policies, that says, to create a gender-sensitive school culture and learning environment so all the students can be included. So it is like to create inclusive school environment.
Thank you. I think generally when most schools are talking about gender, it is a natural assumption that they are considering girls and boys only. That's what gender tends to mean, unless it's specifically stated otherwise. And in that sense as well, it's the binary sense of gender. So we're only considering boys and girls in this. And so the stereotypes that can surround that, because we are only considering that sense of gender, can come into play with schools already. So, Ayana, how does gender manifest in schools?
So it's very interesting to see the role of the school in this context, how we place school within a particular cultural context. So I think it's very important to view schools as a socializing agent and the role that it plays in, for example, socializing gender, because gender, as we know, is something which is socially constructed. So there has to be the influence of many factors which aids in the socialization. And I think it's important to look at the school in a way that it is the first point of entry for a child outside of their immediate family. So when a child first goes into school, the outside world of interacting with people from other backgrounds, that is when they come to realize or come to have a sense of their own identity and what the other is. So schools essentially tend to create ideas of what is masculinity and femininity. What we see, for example, is through very subtle things like the hidden curriculum, which we'll eventually discuss later on also. There are ideals of masculinity and femininity which are set. For example, girls will be asked to behave in certain ways as per the ideal of what it is to be feminine. Like you do not speak with your voice raised, or you sit with your legs close together, those kind of things. And I think in terms of femininity and masculinity, those are the ideals that are perpetuated. And what the other thing it tends to do is the idea of differentiation and separation. For example, girls and boys would be seen as othered, and this differentiation can be seen in the context of, say, sex education classes or sports activities. So you know that there are different things for girls and boys, and that's how it is essentially very gendered.
And also in that hidden and subconscious culture, almost. As an example, when my daughter went to school, she absolutely assumed that in order to have children, you needed to be married. I didn't know that she thought this. She came home one day and she was talking about, you know, you have babies when you're married. And I said, that's not true because we're not married. And you and your brother are here, so we can clearly see that that's not. And she was actually shocked that one, we weren't married. And then the questions for a few years were, why aren't you married? And when are you going to get married? That culture didn't necessarily come from, the school wasn't imposing that, but a subconscious idea that everybody else's parents in the school or in her class are married, so obviously the assumption is everybody needs to be married.
Actually, last night, we had a really great conversation about the construction of masculinity and femininity. And I spoke about, as my experience as a trans person, when I transitioned trying to work out what were gender norms and what were pieces of gender I wanted to take. So how do I now sit now that I'm going to be viewed as a man and not as a woman, even though I'm non-binary? How do I sit? How do I talk? How do I use my hands in conversation? Does my voice go up and down, or does it stay all at the one level? And these are all things that we all have within society. Like those are the gender norms and gender stereotypes that we all exist in. But I think only trans people actually, almost as adults, then realize, oh, these are actually things that people care about. Which ones do I take on, and how do I subvert them?
That moves very nicely on to Sam. How does gender stereotyping impact students?
So there are very few differences between men's brains and women's brains. So, and neuroscientists have seen that. And so most of what gender is created by society and changes quite a lot. And so we can influence this, but also the society creates patterns of gendered behaviors, as I was saying, like how people sit, whether people talk about their emotions, whether they don't talk about their emotions. And this is huge impacts on young people, because those strict ideas can make people feel very closed in and feel that in order to fit in within their peer groups, they have to act in this certain way. So I think one of the most researched impacts and one of the clearest impacts is on mental health. So this idea that boys don't cry or that boys should man up. And what that does is it means that when young men and boys are in distress, they're not talking about it. And it means that they are not getting the support they need or getting a chance to release emotion that otherwise may not cause as many issues. And at the same time, women, when they speak about it, aren't taken that seriously. So women crying or women even self-harming can be seen as feminized and therefore dismissed. And so women's mental health then, when they are talking about it, isn't taken as a seriously as an issue. So we have difficulties all around. In terms of trans and gender diverse or non-binary people, we see really high rates of depression, anxiety, suicide ideation and self-harm, much higher than their peers. And what was really interesting to read is there are certain things that make it harder for trans young people. So whether or not they can access a bathroom safely has a marked impact on their mental health and the experience of mental health, while if they have support of their family and their peers, there is a marked increase in their mental health outcomes. So it shows that if we are slightly less rigid with our gender norms and allow people to express themselves how they want, we actually can see better mental health. I think in society, we can see that gender stereotyping can cause really long-term impacts. We see it among adults, the careers they've taken, what role models are available for children, the subjects that are available in schools, And even in some cultures, how many years people spend in education can be determined by their gender. Or not determined by their gender, but influenced highly by their gender. Teachers have a huge role in reducing these stereotypes and around the toys that they have available in classrooms, the textbooks they choose, the subjects that are available within schools, and how they deal with discipline, whether they discipline men and women and trans and non-binary people differently from each other. This chapter does focus on the policy, but I guess it's really important to say that teachers have agency in terms of how they influence gender within their classrooms. That although we're going to focus on policy, there are so many things that teachers can do within a classroom situation that they have complete control of, whether or not they have a gender policy, to ensure that they reduce the impact of stereotypes.
So as we can see, this topic is quite complicated and broad, which is why the introduction has taken quite a bit of time in itself. So our first question in this chapter is, how does gender interact with school policy? Ayana, can you tell us a bit more about this?
Yeah, so it's very interesting to come to this question at this stage because we've talked about gender, we've talked about school policy. So now it's going to be how they intersect with each other. And at this point, what we see, gender, as we all know, is an identity which is ubiquitous. So it cuts across all identities that people share. So in this regard, any kind of school policy that is formulated is bound to have consequences or connotations for gender in some way or the other. And so we are just going to go through this through examples. For example, the curriculum framework, whether it's at the national level or at the state level. So talking about how representation matters, what kind of things are we seeing in our textbooks? And like Hannah, you spoke about your kids. So the representation of family, how diverse families are we showing in our textbooks? So these are what creates in the minds of children ideas of what an ideal family is supposed to look like, and then change their ideas of surrounding gender, everything. So what comes here is roles and responsibilities, like you said, careers. It all goes on to shape whether women tend to choose the soft sciences, like we all know the stereotypes that are associated with it. So what it does have the impact of is that, or rather runs the risk of reproducing the very same inequalities that have been there in the case of earlier generations. And in another context, if we look at religious schools, for instance, so religious schools also function on the ideology of the particular religion. So in most of the cases, more often than not, we see that the traditional ideas of masculinity and femininity, that is part of the religious ideas, is reflected in schools. And I think all of us have examples to share on this, what we think of religion in schools.
In religious schools, in Turkish context especially, I mean, they had this binary idea about the gender, and then there are women and men. No other people exist in the world, actually. So this is political Islam and ideology that they have about the gender in Turkish context. So there is no policy practice, school practice, about considering the other students other than men and women students.
So I guess in an Irish context, religion is very embedded within our education system. The vast majority of our primary schools, up to about in and around 90% of our primary schools, are Catholic. I think just over 60% or over 60% of our secondary schools are Catholic. So religion isn't an option for most. Well, being in a religious school isn't an option. It is a kind of, that's the school in the area. That's the one you go to. That doesn't necessarily mean that Catholic schools aren't inclusive. So the teachers in Catholic schools aren't trying to be incredibly inclusive of individual students. But what I do see is in Catholic schools, their curriculum like the parts of the curriculum they're doing or how their curriculum is focused tends to be more focused on binary gender roles. And even myself as a student, I remember like we would do a certain amount of sex education within a Catholic school, but then the next week we had a fundamentalist Christian organization come in and talk and do games and have a retreat, but it was all about teaching us abstinence education. And it was a fun 2 days of learning about abstinence, learning about the sin of sex before marriage. As an LGBT person, it was the only time I heard in school that it was a sin to be gay, that it was a time when we were taught how awful abortion was. And these were part of my school life. And so those, although individual teachers were incredibly inclusive and trying to do as much as they could, that's the message the school was also sending. And so you had these two messages, but one was coming from much higher than the other.
I think this is also where it leads us to the idea of same-sex schools, how in terms of policy. So in a same-sex school, the underlying assumption is that we are equating gender with the sex assigned at birth. So people are automatically put into boxes. And like we mentioned before, the ideal is set of masculinity or femininity. And mostly in the case of girls' schools, so on the basis of behavior, there are categorizations of women as good girls, bad girls, or based on their character, tarty girls. So there are all of these categorizations which are mostly based on values. So it's also very important to be acknowledged in the particular cultural context that the school is set, how we perceive gender and how that goes on to the policies which are shaped and how that has bearings on gender.
Also, gender stereotypes are created and reinforced through the hidden curriculum. And we can observe hidden curriculum in all aspects of the school. And for example, the behaviors of the teachers, treatments of the teachers. For example, teachers most of the time say that, okay, while they are controlling the homeworks, they say that, okay, this is what kind of notebook is this? You are the girl, or they don't give same feedback to boys, and it is okay for boys to be messy. And also, they assign different roles, different duties in school context to the girls and boys. And also, another part of hidden curriculum, for example, in our context, you are not talking about the non-binary. People. So it is like it is removed. It is ignored totally. This is hidden curriculum also. So this create. I mean, students just think that when they read the textbooks and teachers don't talk about those in the. In the school, and then so students think that those people do not exist or they are not normal.
I also think an assumption that all schools, or certainly in our societies, is a heteronormative culture. Yes. So an assumption that everybody comes from at least a family, they might not be together anymore, but where you have a man and a woman, a mum and a dad, which, you know, is clearly not the case for a lot of families. So there's a certain underlying othering throughout everybody's school experience. And that may not be same-sex families. That could be that children live with a grandparent or aunts and uncles, or, you know, a different type of diversity that, unless it's, you know, brought actually spoken about, that assumption is that that doesn't exist as well.
The other thing that I think really comes up is around school uniforms in some countries. So whether that's a mixed school, a single gender school, school uniforms tend to be incredibly gendered and very difficult for trans people, particularly in terms of what uniform options do exist, but also then in terms of function. women's, girls' school uniforms tend to be less easy to play sport in, less easy to move in.
Less practical.
Less practical. So, and then we've seen that even in mixed schools, sometimes even if there is a trouser option available, that the girls' and boys' trousers are entirely separate from each other. It makes it very difficult as a trans person to work out what you should be wearing, what you can wear. And the schools can sometimes set gender up as just such the defining characteristics of the children that it becomes very, very challenging within a school environment.
I think this is how we can place the differentiation between the formal curriculum and the hidden curriculum, because when you're teaching the subjects in textbooks, there would be nothing explicitly mentioning that girls and boys are different. They'll say that everyone is equal and preach equality, but it is in these underlying and implicit assumptions where if a girl is wearing a skirt in a school, how constraining it is. So that is how her behavior and actions are supposed to be monitored. That's how the hidden curriculum essentially tends to function. And I think it's more effective in terms of shaping gender.
Yes.
And I think then it seems that the policies can potentially set the hidden curriculum or change the hidden curriculum.
It has the power to do both.
We cannot set it, actually. I mean, we can only be aware of it. I mean, you cannot set hidden curriculum. If you are aware of it, you can just do the opposite. Teacher is aware of it, for example, she would do. School practices can be different, but it is very difficult to set a policy for hidden curriculum. Maybe we can just say, okay, we will be aware of it.
Yeah.
This can be a kind of policy.
So we've talked quite a bit about kind of how gender influences schools. Can you tell us more, Hannah, how trans, non-binary, gender diverse and gender non-conforming students might be included included or excluded by gender policies?
Yeah, I think we've broached on quite a lot of it in this last bit of discussion. But as we've mentioned several times, gender, when it's talked about in schools, it's already naturally assumed that we're talking about the binary sense. And actually, it's not generally even talking about gender, we're talking about sexes. So boys, girls, men, women, male, female, rather than encompassing gender at all. So inherently, by default, trans and non-binary folk are already excluded from all policies regarding gender because it's generally not thought about unless we have specific policies designed to include trans and non-binary folk. And another layer of that is that when schools are talking about gender, they're also always talking about the binary sense of gender as boys and girls. So again, by invisibility alone, non-binary students are not taken into consideration at all. So that's the very basis, I think, of most schooling experiences. It might not be the same throughout the world, but I think most school policies are already kind of coming from that level. So you mentioned school uniforms already, that they're quite gendered, that there's an inherent assumption about who is allowed or given facility to wear those certain uniforms. And I think that the issue that we see coming up in Ireland is that if there is a trouser option, a non-binary or trans person may be welcome to use that trouser option. But quite often schools see it quite differently if a trans girl wants to wear the skirt like all the other girls. That's viewed as slightly awkward or complicated when actually it's not complicated. It's a piece of clothing and should be viewed as such. So that's where policies come in for that. Bathrooms is another space. Again, they tend to always be gendered. If there is a gender-neutral option, often it's one toilet on its own. That is quite often a disability or a universal access toilet. So it's not ideal for non-binary students because, you know, quite clearly they don't often have a disability and don't want to feel like they're taking up space that somebody else should be using. So that's another area. Sports choices and sports facilities is another space. I suppose maybe not so much in primary schools where PE tends to be quite mixed. Maybe again, that changes on culture. But when you get to secondary school, the sports choices are quite gender segregated in most schools. So again, even if trans girls and boys were included, what do non-binary students choose? And are they allowed to make the decision that they see fit, or are they just excluded from sport altogether? And I suppose on the flip side, inclusive policies are schools that either proactively look at all of this prior to setting up any policies, or that at least have a gender identity and expression policy where they are thinking about this in regards to every trans non-binary student who is within the school, as well as anti-bullying policies, which can be good or bad depending on whether they have specific language stating every bit of type of bullying that they are, I suppose, including or deemed inappropriate in a school basis. Rather than saying bullying is bad, are we actually saying, you know, assault, sexual assault, homophobia, transphobia, biphobia, etc., using all that language?
So the second question we're going to answer is, who and what influences gender policies in schools? Yeah. So if we first look at the influences on policy, Jeanette, can you can tell us about this?
Yeah, okay. You know, gender policy at schools are is influenced by very interplay of very complex factors and then stakeholders and actors, we can say. For example, one of them is the government and legislation. Every government has a policy against the discrimination, for example, and then written. And it is written in the constitution most of the time. And then so this have implications for the school policies. And administrators, I mean, those administrators are like appointed bodies or elected bodies in different countries. For example, in our country, they are appointed generally. And they have gender, make decisions about the school policies, and gender is in it, of course, about the gender policies. And educational organizations and unions also influence the school policies or school gender policies. For example, educational groups like National Education Association set some principles or guidelines, and then that make some suggestions to schools about the gender policies. And also unions advocate, the teacher unions or staff unions advocate the gender equality and gender inclusivity in the schools. Also the parents-teacher associations. Parents have, of course, for their kids, are advocates of gender equality and gender inclusivity in school. And they can influence the school policies and then make suggestions about that, or just force them, actually, force the schools to consider this inclusivity or gender equality. And also some community organizations can be like local advocacy groups can also provide some suggestions or advocate gender equality in the schools. And students' councils, I don't know if every country has this. And those kids, of course, defend their rights in school, and then force the school principals or school administrations about the gender inclusivity and gender inclusivity. And also research and academic institutions, they conduct research and make suggestions about that. Media and social media, I mean, they are actually quite influential when we consider the other factors. And also some social movements, these are the like Me Too campaigns, you know, and also then some marches and then global campaigns. Those are all the factors that may affect the gender policies at school.
And what I find happens quite a lot in Ireland in terms of parents' influence on policies is if enough parents have an issue with a certain piece of curriculum that's being rolled out, such as the relationships and sex education piece, schools will create an opt-in or opt-out option. So parents are allowed to take their children out of certain conversations. So that already means you're creating an inequality in the classroom that some children are receiving more information than others, which will certainly create a gender inequality within the classroom, and they will be going out into society without the same information as well, or a biased information.
Also, the NGOs are very influential. I think LGBTQ plus organizations, and then they have campaigns, trainings, and awareness raising activities about the gender equality and gender inclusivity.
And I guess we should, not every influence, unfortunately, within a school is looking towards further gender equality.
Mm-hmm.
So Hannah, can you give us an idea as to what the impact of anti-gender politics is on gender sensitivity in schools?
Yeah, where do we start? So I suppose, first of all, the term anti-gender, I think, has come to rise, you know, quite significantly in the last few years. It appears to be a specific group of people or movement that makes deliberate efforts to undermine certain policies and legislation, particularly around reproductive rights, gender-affirming care, sexuality and relationship education, and LGBTQ plus rights. And it's a specific type of politics that will often position itself as a helpful entity that is trying to protect family values and children, but at the same time, it's attacking freedom of speech, freedom of sexuality and expression, and bodily autonomy. Ideologically, it refers to movements that see gender equality and diversity as threats to society, to traditional values, to the morality of nations. So these are the types of things that they're always, I suppose, seeking to attack and undermine. It's a global movement, and although it's maybe not huge in numbers, it's really far-reaching, and they work through networks of politicians and maybe religious groups and other movements that have specific agendas that align with each other. They can be far-reaching because of the internet and online and being able to reach that far. I think one of the core directives of this movement or anti-gender politics is to frame even the word gender in a very specific way. So gender is being used as a word that is creating a specific ideology or theory rather than a person's factual lived experience. So we're creating a word that becomes something to fear and is threatening, right? And that way they can use it in whatever way that they want to use it. But again, it's always coming back to gender is attacking family values, children's lives, children's safety. We see it a lot in America in terms of the banning of books in libraries, and we're attacking drag queens for telling stories to children. I think certain spaces are always going to be attacked. So in terms of it having a direct impact on schools, it's undermining gender equality, and it's obviously also undermining gender identity expression and LGBTQ persons' lived experiences. By viewing gender as something that is being imposed unwillingly on the population, we can attempt to shut down conversation around gender. So in some instances, gender might not even be able to be talked about within schools. And it's a word that kind of can't even be used, even though it's widely available in the English language and in other languages, right? So first of all, we're going to say that that word cannot be used at all. And then we're going to move on to the spaces where this word can be weaponized in a way. So bathrooms would be one of those spaces. I think we've talked quite a lot about bathrooms already, but it's definitely sensationalized in the media that bathrooms are now unsafe spaces for women and girls because of trans women wanting to use bathrooms. So we have this legitimacy of who can use certain spaces and when they can use them. So both in schools and in public spaces, right?
I can have an example.
Yeah, please.
Mm-hmm. About anti-gender politics. I have an example from my country that the medical school's graduates take Hippocratic oaths in their graduation ceremony, and there is a text. I think this is a universal text.
Yes.
But some of our, let's say, the politicians or deans that... they removed the word sexual orientation, and it was sexual orientation from the text. And while the students are taking Hippocratic oath, the dean first read and they repeat, but students generally resist this and then say this word in between quickly. And then in one of the cases, dean left the ceremony because students did this. So this is actually a very good example of anti-gender politics, I think.
I love how the students added it back in, though.
Yes, they just quickly add.
Yeah.
And then continue.
Yeah, absolutely. I think another space where the anti-gender movement comes in is into girls' uniforms. So whilst the anti-gender political movement is protecting family values, protecting children, protecting women and girls, I think it, more than protecting men, women and girls need to be protected. Things like uniforms or specific female-related uniforms are, you know, really kind of being tried to held onto as a traditional part of valuing. What that does is it polices girls' bodies much more because I think anybody who has had a girl's uniform will attest that, you know, the things that are allowed in relation to girls' uniforms, the measuring of girls' skirts, or making sure that girls are being covered up. You have a very specific example of your own schooling around that.
Yeah, exactly. So we were having this discussion of shirts being transparent. So this whole rule, which was unofficially set in place, that you had to wear a certain kind of slip that would prevent your shirt from being transparent, and that was supposed to be a long one. So the checking for this ensured that the people who were doing the checking would lift the skirts of the girls to check the length of your slip to ensure that everything is being covered from the transparency. So every bit of dignity, agency, and everything is taken away in the name of ensuring, their dignity only. So it's very ironical in that sense.
Yeah, we're taking away your dignity,
exactly,
and choice
just to protect,
your dignity.
The whole idea of protecting female sexuality, resting honor and value in it, it all comes down to that discussion then.
Yeah. So I think at the moment, currently, anti-gender politics seems to really be concentrating very much on trans and non-binary lives or LGBTQ lives, but actually it attacks all forms of gender creates more rigid stereotypes. So it's just as harmful for men and boys as it is for girls and women, because we're reinforcing that notion that men are protectors, should be the main breadwinners and earners, that women are homemakers and childbearers. So all those things that we've been working really hard to move on from are kind of being, you know, brought back.
One of the things that you'd see is within sport. I get very frustrated at sport and the way sport looks at gender. But I think what makes me most frustrated is when you look at the case of Caster Semenya, where they've reduced what it means to be a woman down to how much testosterone a woman has in her body. Caster Semenya, who was assigned female at birth, identifies as a woman who is not allowed to participate in women's sport unless she chemically castrates herself and reduces her testosterone chemically. So it's this idea that a predominantly male organization can decide what makes a woman, and that what makes a woman becomes how much testosterone she has in her body, not anything to do with her own identity.
And the other issue with that is that she only found out that she had higher levels of testosterone because she was forced to get tested by the Olympic Council in the first place. So again, it's another, I suppose, way of demeaning women. In a way, she had no autonomy over that and didn't even know, found out publicly along with everybody else. So our final question is, how can schools integrate gender sensitivity into their policies and practices? Sam, what do you think around this?
So I guess from a higher education perspective, we've done some work in terms of, okay, how do we look at everything and start to develop systems that work for our particular institution? And what we do in higher ed is we look at all the data that's available. That's talking to people, so that's having conversations with our students, with our staff, looking at the cultures that happen within the space. Then we get as much quantitative data as we can. Now, you may get more or less depending on your size of school and what you can do. And then we look to develop an action plan that's based on our own experiences. So some places may focus a lot on gender-based violence. Others might look at the access to bathrooms or their uniform. And then we will review that and see how we're getting on with those policies. I know that we'd spoken about some actions that we think that might be helpful. So I guess one of the ones we'd spoken about was period dignity work and the fact that schools could look to develop period dignity and sanitation and sanitary facilities policies. So for example, does every bathroom in the school have a bin? And that if every bathroom in a school had a bin, that would mean that any young boy who perhaps had incontinence issues would be able to use the same bathroom as all of their peers, as well as allowing any trans person who might need to use a sanitary pad access to a bin, as well as then looking within that policy at, okay, can we provide free period products to all of our students and give access to free menstrual products?
And simple ones like having an open uniform policy, that we have lots of individual items available that will make every student feel comfortable. That's in a shop, and you can go and choose which items of clothing you want to wear as part of the school uniform, and that's, you know, inclusive of everybody, and everybody can choose the parts of uniform that they want. If there's a uniform, I know that in lots of countries they don't have uniforms. I also think that schools kind of looking at their natural biases and then opening it up from there. So that way we're working proactively from a point of view that we understand that we all come from certain backgrounds, and our lived experiences do mold who we are. So we naturally have positive and negative biases, both conscious and unconscious. And if we work to open that up, we will be thinking in a more gender-inclusive way already, I think.
Another dimension that we should consider while integrating the gender in school policies, curriculum. We should change the whole curriculum And the textbooks, actually. And then just remove all the stereotypes in the textbooks and then in the topics. Another one is related to curriculum is pedagogical practices. I mean, how we teach and what are the strategies that we use in teaching students, and then teachers should be very careful about their language and their discourse that they use in the classroom. So those are also the dimensions that we should consider in integrating gender inclusivity or gender gender in the school policy. Do you have something to say?
Mm-hmm. I think following a lengthy discussion on taking into aspect every aspect of gender, taking into account all of those, to sum it up, I think we need a like we started off with a definition of gender, so even the commonsensical understanding of gender that in a very narrow sense, it is just the social manifestation of the biological sex. So in that sense, if we broaden it to understand gender as something along a spectrum with masculinity and femininity at two ends of it, and every point of the spectrum, there is a freedom and space for individuals in terms of identity, affiliation, expression, orientation. So if we come to look at gender in this broad way, then I think that sums up our whole chapter on gender and school policy. And that awareness will lead to a lot of gender difference in
and teacher training
the good way.
Is needed.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think
this.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing to say is we're not going to do it all at once.
No.
Nobody start, well, very few people are starting with a school that doesn't have any national curriculum and can create all of its own policies. It's taking a gendered lens, and as you're working at increasing the gender equality within your school, it's one step at a time, it's one policy at a time, it's one day at a time, and it can't all be done at once.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of All Means All. In the show notes, there's a link to the chapter in the open textbook. There you can find the transcript of the video and more information on the topic.